dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And
as we you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. For the past few months, I've been reading you exclusively each week from the 2006 book, The Ascent of Humanity, The Age of Separation, The Age of Reunion, and The Convergence of Crises That's Birthing the Transition by Charles Eisenstein. This week, we're going to begin Chapter 7, where he puts forward his ideas of how the workings of various aspects of human society could be transformed to be appropriate to what he calls the Age of Reunion. But first, I'm going to play you a talk recorded this weekend at the New York Greenfest, held in Alfred by the Green Party of New York. In keeping with the Greens' advocacy of sustainability, decentralization, and direct democracy, the Green Party attracts many people with a do-it-yourself outlook, and their gatherings reflect that. Presentations about campaigning and elections were a small part of what was offered by the 80 or so presenters. In addition to themes that you will be familiar with as a listener to this show, sustainability, local sovereignty, food systems, media, environmental destruction, economics, and the relationship between those things, there were workshops on writing poetry from place, making felt and tofu, growing nut trees, and building your own wind turbine. Some of the presenters were nationally and internationally recognized speakers, writers, and thinkers. Others were some of the many people who are doing and thinking, but are unknown outside their local communities. The speaker I'm going to play you for the first hour of the program this week is one such person, John Dosher of Lockwood in Tioga County, New York. The presentation he gave, Capitalism as Culture, reflects a lifetime of his research and thinking about sustainability. And when I say lifetime, I mean lifetime. He's 82 years old. What was remarkable to me, and why I'm going to play it along with the reading from Charles Eisenstein, is that some of John's statements could have been taken directly from Eisenstein's work, but he has never heard of him. Both of them have a perspective that defies traditional political categories. I'm speculating that both of them have probably, in the course of their study to understand the nature of our problems, read some of the same seminal thinkers like Kirkpatrick Sale and Wendell Berry. But it may also be the case that they themselves reach the same conclusions as Sale and Berry from their direct observation. Just as we heard last week of the search for the first replicating molecule, we in our culture tend to speak as if every new thing must descend from a single creator. Our patent law system is based on that premise. But the reality is that many things arise independently in various places, as did agriculture, because they are ultimately obvious. Like Charles, John is unafraid to raise ideas that are deeply controversial and which do not generally appear in juxtaposition. A friend of mine told me about John after she heard him give a talk to a community group whose members, she felt, by the way, did not give him or his ideas the respect they deserved. John Dosher is not on the internet, and the presentation that I'm about to play you was composed on a typewriter. As he was setting up to do his talk, he mentioned to me that this was going to be his last public lecture on account of his age. He felt he needed to do some other things, like get a tractor. The room was small and echoed, and an air conditioner ran continuously. I've done the best I could with it. So here's John Doscher speaking on August 8th, 2009, on capitalism as culture.
I'm going to talk today about capitalism as culture. The philosophical foundation for capitalism consists mainly of the ideology called classical liberalism. It draws on certain philosophers such as Hobbes, Locke, Law, and Adam Smith while badly distorting their views. The core of that ideology is that certain people are better than others, that property is more important than people, that there is no God, that the primary reality is material, and that there is no intrinsic value in anything, only exchange value, that is, money value. Rather than be essentially the same, rather than trace the old history, I'll trace more of recent history. The values I expose will be essentially the same, so I can save time. Smith believed that free markets should be regulated and frowned upon monopoly and other forms of concentration. That's not generally known or acknowledged today. He hoped that people pursuing selfish gain would be guided to somehow pursue the public good. There never was such an invisible hand. Capitalism is a market system that has an incredibly bad set of values under philosophical perspectives. It's a classist social system with a criminal ethic. It prefers a system of governance that, by design, favors the corruption of society and the destruction of all life values, a system called representative democracy that is neither representative nor democratic, leading inevitably to dictatorship of, by, and for the rich. It's a purely materialist system that leaves no room for spirituality at all. For my purposes, the modern era started in the late 1500s with the invention of the corporation in Holland. The East India Company began in England in 1601. It soon took over all of the Indian subcontinent. Then the British government took over. One of the important tenets of classical liberalism still operative is that the international role of the sovereign, besides defense, is to support the agendas of domestic business interests abroad by force, if necessary, that is, by conquest. That idea was not too strange to them because one of their beliefs was that there is a natural state of war between all men, requiring a sovereign to keep order so that business could go forward. Internationally, the only conceivable sovereign then and now was the empire. We'd had better hopes than for an imposed sovereign and corporate dominance when we declared our independence from England because of the practices of that same East India Company in the American colonies. We hoped that our new 1787 Constitution would lead us out into a new existential space where we could be free from oppression and have a truly just dispensation. We sought a new kind of sovereignty, one of the people, a sovereignty of, by, and for the people. But that hope ended with the entirely gratuitous and treasonous opinion. No case, no argument, no decision of the Supreme Court in 1886 that the corporation is, by the terms of the 14th Amendment, a person. It was completely contrary to all prior law and practice. Little matter, too, that the court reporter and some of the justices, including the Chief Justice, had very close ties to certain railroad interests which had been pushing that view. No national electorate has since been able to successfully oppose the power that then went to the corporations. So today, we have a corporate sovereign, the sovereignty of the people having been overthrown. The result is also, to make it plain, that our government, all three branches, has long been illegitimate. That opinion, as wrong as it clearly was treated ever after as law. What we have then is an elite consensus that became law through the back door. The 1939 through 45 Warrant Peace Studies Project of the Department of State and the Council on Foreign Relations, led by the David Rockefeller forces, recommended that the U.S. create a world empire and that it achieve permanent military dominance. That led to all the wars since then. Our support of death squads, our use of mercenary armies, Iran-Contra, and so on. A course in which the U.S., by my own count, has killed directly and indirectly about 15 million people after World War II, and counting. It had one more step to go. In 1973, the Trilateral Commission, the same forces, recommended, one, that the U.S. should bring our European allies and Japan into the empire as partners, and two, that the U.S. had too much democracy and should have a managed democracy, that is, a disguised dictatorship. From 1945 on, there was a series of decisions and actions that initiated the imperial program, the creation of a UN dominated by the Security Council, that is, by the U.S. and its allies, the Bretton Woods Agreements, the GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the World Bank, the IMF, recast to serve U.S. imperial interests, the WTO, NAFTA, CAFTA, and so on. The major tools used to advance the empire were these: risk-assessed loans charging up to 17% interest that could not be invested in import-substituting industries but only for infrastructure. Free trade agreements that the U.S. itself violated, for example, with huge subsidies for U.S. farm exports, which put indigenous small farmers abroad out of business, as in Haiti, leading to famine. Free trade agreements that permitted cheap foreign imports, for example, from China, which was not a WTO member at the time, but not manufactures from the weaker third world nations, to put U.S. domestic firms out of existence and U.S. workers out of jobs, except for jobs paying half as much. All that coupled with foreign direct investment agreements that permitted foreign firms such as Toyota to come in, hire only young workers so that today they may have only 700 retirees as against GM's 30,000. All but guaranteeing the demise of U.S. automakers. Agreements that permitted U.S. firms to relocate abroad and to use slave labor in venues with almost no operative workplace, environmental, retirement, health, or social security costs so that they could send goods back to the U.S., make 40 to 70% profits, stash the cash in transnational tax shelters, pay almost no U.S. taxes, and put more U.S. workers out of work. An open door policy to Mexican slave labor, outsourcing the importation of foreign contract workers for technical jobs, the co-option of the governments and militaries of third world nations, unpayable predatory loans, assassinations, massacres as in Indonesia in 1965 of up to 2 million people, destabilization programs, the patenting of seeds, the use of disappearance networks, the propagation of conflict, and the use of lies to create excuses to attack other countries, such as, for example, Iraq. The illegal use of money to affect foreign relations and foreign elections, and the use of powerful demolition explosives, says a Swedish scientist now, who's analyzed dust samples from the site to bring down the Twin Towers in order to turn the people against Islamist extremists and to accept the effective negation of the writ of habeas corpus and of other citizen protections, so that today we are no longer, in fact, citizens, but subjects. Every single one of the premises of that English ideology at the core of capitalism has been disproved. That mad ideology continues because it creates and serves a controlling, a predatory elite. It continues because were it given up, they would soon be overthrown. What most people believe is what those leaders want them to believe. And it has brought us to this day when we can sense the impending collapse of society and of the biosphere. What the capitalist ideology and institutions, which have developed a definitive set of values and of practices, have done, among all the rest, is to destroy Christianity and any other religion that has any spiritually centered value set. For example, in service of Spanish imperial interests, Catholic theologian Juan Gaines de Sepulveda in 1550 developed a set of rationalizations for the church that justified the conquest, enslavement, and mass murder of Native Americans, the taking of their lands, and the destruction of their cultural and historical records and accomplishments. The English Protestants were not to be outdone, however. As Locke's justification of the enslavement of people without property showed, thus poor people and Native Americans, who largely had communal property, merited enslavement and conquest. Debtors' jails became so crowded that prisoners were used to colonize Australia and Georgia. Christianity, the main religion in the U.S. and Europe, has been so compromised by powerful political and economic interests that it no longer has anything spiritually and morally coherent to say to anyone, with perhaps a very few exceptions. And I'm a Christian. It sanctions war, greed, conquest, justifiable homicide, and God wants you to be rich, gospels. It has abandoned the spiritual center and attempts to sacralize the physical, as in its human life begins at conception doctrine of recent years, which ignores the entire question of ensoulment. It threw out liberation theology, which attempted to address long-neglected justice issues and concerns the Bible is full of. It has thrown Jesus out and still calls itself Christian. It throws out the Ten Commandments while yet claiming a historical spiritual heritage. A Christian leader, Pat Robertson, was quoted as calling for the assassination, if you recall, of Hugo Chavez. Whatever one may think of Chavez, that's not Christian. It has meant the end of the love ethic, of the concept that in God we are all one and all equal. A concept that is anathema to capitalism. It meant the end of the concept that real community really matters, and that service next to love and without self-aggrandizement, that is, without using one's God-given gifts to advance self over others, is the highest duty. The overthrow and corruption of Christianity, of all spiritual knowledge in all traditions, has left us without any valid and cogent spiritual guidance for behavior or policy. Power and wealth are all that matter. The powerful make the laws for themselves. This was all best expressed, in my opinion, in Nietzsche's diatribe against the Judeo-Christian ethic, which he called a slave ethic. And he inadvertently brought us to a new understanding, namely, that our basic philosophical choice with respect to behavior and values is between just two things, separation and oneness. A choice so analogous to the ancient one given us to choose between good and evil that they are, for all practical purposes, identical. The view that Nietzsche and the English expressed is one that I have given the name moral separationism. It is the view that we are all separate from one another. That existential separation, the separation of our beings, means that whatever we may do to another has no necessary internal, no spiritual effect whatsoever on ourselves. We may gain or lose in some material way from such a transaction. That's all. Unless someone comes after us seeking revenge for a loss we've imposed on them. But if we, Nietzsche's we, not we here, control the law and the apparatus of the state, all the troops, that is, we can make a safe and secure place for ourselves. Therefore, it is entirely okay to kill, rape, commit mass murder, oppress, enslave, conquer, lie, and steal. Those who are able to do this successfully deserve all the rewards. Other people, the losers, are by definition inferior and have only one meaningful role in history, says Nietzsche, to serve that predatory elite. That is the spirit of this age. Those very few, such as Mahatma Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who've led people away from that abyss of the spirit, stand so far beyond today's top leaders as to be non-comparable. It is extremely rare to be able to point to such a difference of kind, even in history. They have shown that spirit, when people take it into themselves, cannot be suppressed or turned aside. There is an explicit value system that guides our corporate sovereign. It can be enlightening to consider it. Here it is. Inequality. Power. Wealth. Property as absolute right, not as use rights, constrained to assure sustainability and morality. Profits as elite property rather than as a fiduciary responsibility to those who pay them, who are the real owners, and competition, which, when it supersedes cooperation as a principle, is war. There is not one concession to the value of life, any kind of life, except as property and the ownership of property by persons such as corporations. These are the values of a sociopathic monster. The monster the Supreme Court empowered in 1886, and that the Dutch first raised, and that the English and the Americans perfected from 1601 on. These are the values that rose out of classical liberalism, the very values that led straight to Nietzsche's doctrine of the Übermensch, the overman. These are values guaranteed to lead to the destruction of humanity, perhaps also the biosphere, leaving a sterile earth. These are values straight out of hell. With the patenting of life, adjudged by the court in 1980 to be an invention, there is no longer any real basis in law or in culture for anything decent or sane or hopeful. Will oxygen be next? Might the existing patent on a Panamanian woman's genome become the basis for a genetically modified human who can then be adjudged to be property and bring us back to formal slavery? In profaning life, we opened the door to the profanation of humanity, of spirit, and it has begun. And there is an actor ready, willing, and able to take over the ownership, use, and disposal of such properties, the corporation and the predatory elite it serves. At some point, I realized that imposed inequalities have been a primary means by which predatory elitism is supported. In June of 2007, I developed a statement for my church about justice. It's this, quote, "The imposition of an inequality on any person or class of persons that disadvantages them in relation to any other person or class of persons is unjust, unethical, and harmful," end quote. The identification of imposed inequalities, the study of how they are imposed, and of how they work, and of the full range of their consequences, can be a very fruitful way of approaching many justice issues and to develop solutions for them. Here's a list of some imposed inequalities. 1. Corporate directors generally serve on several boards. They're usually chosen by the CEO, and they in turn determine the benefits paid to the top officers, either directly or through a committee. The directors themselves are usually high executives of other companies. That is, as a group, corporate executives set their own incomes, with no upper limit other than the cash flow of the corporation each manages. Corporate cash flows are huge, but they are finite. Therefore, the more the executives take for themselves, the less there is for floor workers and shareholders. These days, that's just about everyone, corporations having come to dominate the economy. In 1999, the average ratio of CEO to floor worker pay was 800 to 1. Today, that ratio is down to about 300 to 1, still monstrous. 2 and 3. Corporations claim ownership of all profits and largely take them for executive and corporate income and for shareholder dividends. What real right do they have to do that other than in law? None. Consumers are required to pay the profit in order to have the good. Scarcity is imposed by producers who won't produce at a break-even price or even at a low profit price, the supply-side economic ploy. This is easy when a market is dominated by just a few large producers who can easily collude as to production levels and price ranges. That condition is called oligopoly, just one step from monopoly. Profits represent the difference between supply and demand. The greater the supply shortfall, the greater the profits. Just what are customers paying for when they pay profits? They're paying for the scarcity imposed by the corporation's decision maker. They're paying, that is, to be ripped off. Who actually owns the profits? The consumers, until they receive real value for having paid them. There is a way that could all be made fair and square, to reinvest those profits, all of them, in increasing or upgrading the production of the very good that brought them in. Were that done, then soon the market would be satisfied. Supply would equal demand when the average profit rate reaches zero. That would, of course, leave the thieves quite unhappy. Who would invest if there were no return? But the real return for investment is production. A thief living alone on a desert isle wouldn't be able to invest, even if Che had a chest full of gold. Investment and savings always involve social effort. What the fight is about is just who controls it all and who benefits most. Individuals who have money to invest get that money in only so many ways. They can use leverage, for example, means control, a psychological concept, to extract more money from a client or customer than the customer makes, so that their own income is higher. They lend that surplus income to others, extracting a profit called interest, and profit even more from foreclosures, buying up real property when it's let go for a song. They use their power as an employer to pay employees much less than themselves. They lie, cheat, and steal, as did Madoff. They gamble. They inherit wealth they didn't create, using laws passed by their parents. All that failing, they take it by force. Always have. Loan sharking is very profitable if you know how to break legs. Does anyone remember the protection rackets? The prostitution rings? The dope trade? The professional assassins? The ward bosses? The arms traders? The great empires? Those who hack into credit accounts? In this kind of economy, it takes money to make money. Real money, that is. If that's what life is all about, anything goes. And it does. The propaganda is that without big investors, without privatization of the control of wealth, society would become a communist slave state. I don't know about you, but I've never known such a state. There's plenty of wage slavery in the U.S. Corporations are dictatorships that control employees' every move and every word. I've never seen actual communism anywhere beyond the family level. The Soviet Union was, in my opinion, a form of state capitalism. They tried since before 1917 to learn from the Prussians. So they wound up with a paternalistic, semi-feudal state capitalism without a real market system, having been unable to fully emulate the Prussian model. Their crimes and failures, like ours, were all covered up by lies. Materialism, theirs and ours, begets egoism, which begets me-firstism, which begets predatory elitism and statism. For corporations don't only control levels of production to impose scarcity so as to assure profitability, they also control hiring levels and thereby wage levels. If there were 100% employment, that would imply a demand for labor that emptied the barrel. There could even be a scarcity of labor. The price of labor could exceed that of management. So corporations limit hiring to what would be a profitable production level. And they also limit hiring to what will assure a surplus of labor. After all, if workers have to compete for jobs, then the price of a job goes up, and the price of labor goes down. There are still other ways for the elite to wage their class war, for example, 5 and 6. They get the government, the one they own, to adopt a free trade, unlimited, unbalanced, unregulated trade policy. The U.S. market is then flooded with goods from slave labor venues. The labor movement falters and fails as well-paying jobs disappear. Domestic producers, outsold by the cheap imports, quit hiring. Then they close up shop or move to China, India, Indonesia, or Malaysia. Real wages here have declined to half what they were in 1950. Workers, who are also consumers, do three things in order to be able to survive. A, they send their wives or husbands to work and raise latchkey kids. B, they buy cheaper imported goods, killing more U.S. jobs. C, they borrow. Then they do a fourth, D, they go bankrupt, and the economy suffers a major contraction. Those worst off do still other things. They turn to crime, thus becoming the mirror image of the elite. The corporations get the government to adopt a foreign direct investment policy so that U.S. producers can move to slave labor venues. They either, one, sell back to the still relatively rich U.S. market at profit rates exceeding 40%, or two, they serve the domestic market in that slave venue. In both cases, they take the profits for themselves and store them in transnational tax shelters These two things together have spelled the death of U.S. labor, the deindustrialization of the U.S. economy, and the destruction of our tax base. 7, they got on the pro-birth bandwagon about the time, 1970, of the adoption of the rollback policy, which ended real aid to third world nations. Why? There are profits in enlarging markets. The more consumers, the larger the markets. With more workers, there are lower wages. That these policies must eventually destroy society, since the biosphere is not infinite, doesn't matter. That'll be someone else's problem. 8, they drop both corporate taxes and taxes on high incomes. They also eliminate the so-called death tax, the tax on inheritances. That enriches the already rich in ways that lock in the wealth and power of their family line seemingly forever. It also eliminates our tax base. That has become a problem. So, of course, they have no choice but to eliminate pensions and Social Security and so on. And there's a lot of pressure on for all that. But if the U.S. collapses, they'll have their guarded estates and foreign properties. That elite haven't really been U.S. citizens since before World War II. See Michael Parenti's book, Super Patriotism, pages 117 through 121, to find out about big U.S. companies that continued to operate in Hitler's Germany, that used slave labor, produced weapons to kill Americans, and then collected money from the U.S. for damages to their plants by Allied bombings. No U.S. corporate manager has ever been held accountable for any of that. Clear as day, another elite consensus. These people live in transnational space and owe no one but themselves any allegiance at all. It should be apparent that the further this kind of thing goes, the further it will go. It can't last forever, even on its own terms. If we add in all the feedbacks, like global warming, mass extinction, overpopulation, resource depletion, and the impoverization of the U.S. population, we can see that carried forward much farther, such a culture must inevitably lead to human extinction, perhaps as early as 2070, or if there's nuclear war, any time from here on. A simple rule is that if workers aren't paid enough to be able to purchase what they produce, then the domestic economy will move into depression, as it has. That can be circumvented for the rich by some of the means I've listed, especially the combination of so-called free trade and of foreign direct investment, a better name for which is flight of capital. The capital that the people paid for. Those are the cures for them, the causes for everyone else. The main whole system cures, besides ending corporate personhood and the imperial plan, are mandated balanced trade and the elimination of foreign ownerships, both here and there. They'd be major initiatives for any U.S. recovery. They'd also put an end to U.S. imperialism. As a general solution for all countries, it would, for the first time, establish a just and beneficial system of trade and investment internationally. There are ways to provide real aid, not fake aid, to developing countries. They don't have to involve loans. Those two initiatives, if adopted universally, would enable developing countries to actually develop autonomously in ways that really serve their own people. There are also others. Keynesian solutions won't work under a regime of free trade, and I'll repeat, unlimited, unbalanced, unregulated trade, and of flight of capital. For that reason, I expect the present stimulus, even though it concentrates on infrastructure, not to produce any permanent growth in the U.S. economy. Most of the money, once spent as wages, will be respent for imports. The profits of what is spent for American goods will largely go abroad, for flight of capital. The portion collected by other American workers for wages will largely be spent for imports, and so on. The portion spent for solar and wind power will largely be respent the same ways. But U.S. imports of energy will be reduced accordingly, and that might actually help. With these two reforms, Keynesian methods might work internationally too. One in the form of General Assembly administered grants funded by a flat tax levied by all nations on all international transactions and flows, and two, in the form of U.S. credits to other nations spendable only in the U.S. for example, wind and solar development. That would stimulate production and hiring, too, here. The banks would hate that, of course. Nationally, such solutions would work better if all profits were reinvested and if a proper upper limit were set on individual income. The U.S. dollar has paradoxically increased in value as we've moved into prolonged recession. People aren't spending and borrowing as before. The savings rate has risen to 5% from less than zero, and many more continue to go bankrupt, so purchases continue to decline, and we have many more mortgages that will fail. That pulls money out of circulation, and the money supply shrinks. The dollar increases in value as against the total of goods and services available. That's called deflation. For a while, imports will actually increase due to the increased value of the dollar. But exports will decrease, costing more, and our international debts will increase accordingly. The dollar will have to fall eventually. We now owe other countries up to $6.6 trillion, and that debt continues to grow at close to $1 trillion a year. The price of oil will rise as pumping rates finally fail to be able to meet demand, probably in 2010, perhaps a little later due to the U.S. contraction. China, Russia, Iran, and others are getting restive about their hordes of dollars that bring little income and that will soon decrease in value. China, for example, has begun to buy gold and also IMF bonds. That's the International Monetary Fund, which governs so much of what goes on internationally. As the price of gold rises, the dollar will fall. The decline of the dollar will mean a further decline in the value of the work of U.S. citizens. That is, a further decline in real incomes. When people we buy from don't buy from us, that is a direct attack on the value of U.S. labor. The bankruptcy of the U.S. is rapidly moving from de facto to de jure status, that is, to legal status. If when that occurs, we won't be able to import oil or gas. Today, we import 72% of those needs. That would very adversely affect agriculture and transport, bringing severe hunger to the U.S. on a large scale. We typically have a 62-day food reserve, not more. We're about out of time economically. It could still be reversed if the right things are done, but not for much longer. We have to act now or fail. Even these are only partial solutions. It'll take at least 20 years at full speed for us to be able to change enough coal into oil and gas to bring us back to today's levels of energy. Present plans are to reduce greenhouse emissions 20% by perhaps 2050, and now they've said something like 80%. But, says one group of scientists, if all greenhouse emissions aren't ended by 2016 worldwide, then global warming will be out of control, and the Earth's average temperature will rise 18.2 degrees, extinguishing mankind. When? By 2070. There is the claim, the premise, that some kinds of work are more important, more valuable than others. But if that were really true, then why all the imposed inequalities? The underlying premise is that some people are better than others. They use their gifts to oppress their brothers. By that very act, they prove their own inferiority, a profound moral and spiritual inferiority. Where has it led? To vast social misery, to endless wars in which the prime targets become civilians, to nuclear weapons, and to the destruction of the biosphere. To, that is, an overwhelming stupidity. Geniuses give birth to morons, and vice versa. The sexual mode of reproduction leads to diversity, which has survival value, but it can carry a price. That could be overcome rather easily by an intelligent breeding program. Eugenics can have its uses. But as we saw in the Third Reich, it fit in all too easily with a master race doctrine and death camps. Not every job requires genius. Is it therefore worth less? We tend to think of floor washers, seamstresses, and ditch diggers as an inferior class whose work must be worth less than that of others. Is it? Could we get along without clothing? Could we today survive without water conduits, sewage removal, and processing? buried cables, or tunnels? Could we get along in work quarters that become cesspools of filth and infection? It isn't the work that's worthless. It's the people themselves who are adjudged less valuable because they don't have power. They lost their power as members of a community when society became hierarchical and when community was destroyed. With the advent of great self-serving hierarchies, power became an agent of a vast separation of the agendas of the powerful from those of any really workable society. If intelligence is not used for the common good, but for self-aggrandizement, for gaining advantage over others, its use becomes sociopathic, and humanity leads itself and the earth towards destruction. We had no need for administrators and hierarchies in reasonably sized communities long ago, but could rely on participatory cooperative forms of governance and organization of work, and on individual artisans who served the community well, who had a real sense of community. As hierarchies proliferated and developed more levels, however, outside interests, such as armies, commerce, banking, and industry, came into communities, took over their commons, their intelligently managed commons, and converted independent workers to wage slaves. That continues today in the form of free trade and foreign direct investment, both within and between nations. Big boxes typically ship out 83% of their cash flow. Chains and concessions ship out about 63%. If an outside industry moves into a community, it too easily becomes the major employer. Local banks and local governments come under the control of such employers and cater to their interests. They can control who gets credit, contracts, and jobs. They can threaten to leave if taxed. They can drive out mom-and-pop operations by using their financial resources to sell at below cost and to deny them credit through their new friends, the banks. Soon they rule the roost, for a larger community adds several more and bigger with the same result. Free trade that forces market penetration and that's combined with investment from outside in converts affected communities into colonial dependencies subject to the dumping of wastes, the taking and destruction of water resources that destroy all autonomy, to wage slaves earning the bare minimum. The local tax base declines. Schools become hard to support. If people can leave, they do, as in New York State, where farmers have fallen prey to outside interests, like middlemen, processors, and suppliers. Throughout all this, we get the same thing. Executives and other people high on the pay chain are confirmed in their superiority and in the primacy of their needs by their pay scales, while others suffer. But an interesting thing happened. An article in the Scientific American about 1980, more than 20 years ago, almost 30, reported that researchers in decision theory had determined that the roles of top executives as agents of production, and I would say probably not as wargamers, and of doctors could be programmed and the programs steadily improved. That was rejected by those powerful people, of course, and no one else was able to test all that out. But just think, we could replace a $100 million a year CEO with a machine costing a few bucks a day. Very attractive idea. And ditto a doctor who charges $230 or more an hour. Pay scales are prices. These can be controlled, as can any other production costs and relationships, as I showed earlier, by manipulations that favor one group over another. Our economic system has long been governed informally by powerful interests who favor themselves, but it's turned out that we really do need system-wide formal controls, not by those interests, but by society. How, however, can that be done without creating yet another and even worse set of hierarchies? Hierarchies come with size and complexity and with the takeover of society by interests, be they centered in wealth or power or ideology. These are lessons that we can all see and learn for ourselves if we look and think to expose the kinds of systemic relationships they create, the nature of the overall system they create. It's an appalling system. Today we approach several end points, trend end points, each trend being entirely destructive at supersonic speed, accelerating into a fiery final descent. What can we do? We can downsize cities, towns, and nations. Severe downsizing. Nations of not more than 8 to 12 million. Cities of not more than 35,000, made up of 100 communities of about 350 people each, about the optimum size. We can adopt a different form of governance, too. The first solves other problems as well, such as sustainability in combination with other changed practices. We can create a network system of city-states that are net self-sufficient in renewables, such as food, fish, fiber, timber, water, energy, and seeds, trading these only within categories, for example, timber only for timber, and only for variety not supply, for example, bananas for apples, both within the food category. The city-states are sustainably integrated with their surrounding natural context. They practice mandated balanced trade and explicitly choose to exercise cooperation and mutual help free of charge rather than competition as the essential ethical rule. They relate heterarchically and practice participatory democracy at every level and between levels. By heterarchy, or heterarchy, is meant that instead of hierarchies, there exist mutual reciprocities in which each participant person, community, city, and nation is equally empowered so that none may dictate to any other, each council having veto power at its own level relative to the next most inclusive council, for example. The real power in every case goes back to the local community, which always has the final say as to standards and rules it must follow within a common organic law that sets in advance overall necessary criteria and standards. One that sets standards as floors, not ceilings, just the reverse of what is done now. Another change, localize all production and consumption, most especially of agricultural and forestry products first, and then go on to localize as many other industries as possible. We need, too, an interlocutor between ourselves and nature, empowered to act forcefully as nature's agent, to charge the costs, to set the prices, to set and enforce the limits, to supply the remedies. Who really owns the lands, the ecosystems, the oceans, the wetlands, the rivers? Nature owns them. We most decidedly do not. We have to apply that understanding to the way we relate to nature. These are all part of nature's system. We ourselves have use rights like all other creatures. Those use rights must be constrained to fit nature's needs, not only ours, because nature must come first. Nature's essential principles are community and diversity. The precautionary principle has to be our first rule in dealing with nature. Because if we go too far, it may take millions of years to repair the damages, millions of years in which our species will have disappeared early on. We have to make community with nature. In today's terms, it means that we place all of today's so-called externalities, costs kept external to the bottom line, at the top of the list, not the bottom. That interlocutor has to have the first and last say, and we must obey. It must also be held accountable according to a strict set of criteria. This is our last chance. We can start to create such an interlocutor with the reestablishment of each community as subsisting as part of a managed commons, consisting first of an agricultural and forestry land trust combined with a producer-consumer co-op. We also have to commit to the cooperation of small local cities, none larger than 35,000, each made up of small real communities, to create nature preserves adequately sized and connected to restore and preserve both species and genetic diversity. The smallest such preserve in the Northeast would be about 57 miles in diameter, if circular, larger if not, connected by broad corridors to other such preserves. For a group of 12 such cities, about 420,000 people, that would require a set-aside of 5 acres per person. Such efforts will meet with resistance, but people can create conservation and also community land trusts and purchase land for their own needs in perpetuity. And a producer-consumer co-op is probably also legal. If the going gets too tough, there's still civil disobedience and the refusal to purchase things not produced locally. Community-supported agriculture groups can set up canning centers or parties. Food canned in glass, by the way, is much safer. And so on. Another central lesson is that we need a new existential centering. I offer one. I call it the ancient spiritual wisdom updated. It can be extracted from many sources, all of which converge. I put it in the form of several statements. One, there is a one, the source of all that is eternal, in some way sentient and ever-present. Two, we are all, as is all else, extensions of that one. In spite of our seeming separation, we are all one. We have never left, nor really separated from the one, or from the oneness, except in our minds. There is only the one. Nothing else exists. The one is all. Three, the prime rule in oneness is love. Nothing else can take its place. Four, whatever we do to any other, we do also to ourselves. Our belief in separation has created for us an experienced reality that manifests all the consequences of separation. That can be overcome by a return to oneness. Five, reincarnation has been proved. Were it rejected as non-science, then we would also have to reject astronomy as science, because we cannot experimentally manipulate the stars any more than we can manipulate God. Real research has been done, and it has proved that between lives, our personas and all our past personas are held in mind by an apparent higher self. All the past personas become part of the unconscious of the next persona as they, in the form of ensoulment, enter the new projection, the new body. There are karmic rules in reincarnation. We, quote, meet self, end quote. That can act as a sort of moral law, bringing a sort of justice. However, its prime purpose is to make us aware of who we really are. Six, real human community provides a means through which we can approach oneness. In real human community, each is dependent on every other and on all for just very life. Everyone knows everyone else face to face, and all relationships are characterized by deep mutual reciprocities. If one is given a gift by God, that gift is given not for one's self-advancement over others, but for the common good. In community, the highest value, along with love, must be service. If each person does whatever Che is best able to do for others, then the return to oneness and to the source becomes possible. Seven, as extensions of the one, all things have the same powers as does that one in due measure. Our highest destiny is to be co-creators. Eight, in our original state, justice was never a concern, since all lived in oneness, love, and service. Here, in our experienced separation, justice does become an issue. We can approach it through a study of imposed inequalities and teach each other about oneness, love, community, service, and creativity. Nine, God has never left us and is ever-present and universally imminent. It is we who have left God in our thoughts. As did the prodigal son, we too can return. 10, in spite of the appearance of separation, there is an underlying oneness that supports all. Two material examples of such oneness are A, the biosphere and its many subsystems, called ecosystems, each of which consists of a natural community and its habitat, and B, the real human community. The fashion today is to deny that anything spiritual can exist. However, work in physics, such as Bell's theorem, and the related aspect experiments performed by Alain Aspect, indicate that space and time are a secondary reality that does not really apply in all cases as we think it should. A world without a true space and time must also be a world without energy and matter, because they are defined in terms of space and time. Perception has a peculiarity that makes it impossible to prove that there is any material reality external to the perceptuum, the part of us that perceives. Identity and change turn out to be contradictory. Therefore, the concept of a universal change poses great difficulties. What this all says is that materialism is a philosophical position that stands on very infirm ground. God may well turn out to be far different from what most believers believe, but a universe of spirit mind now seems very much more likely as a primary reality than does one of space-time, energy, matter. As to proofs, there are only a few positive proofs for these beliefs, because we seem so far unable to penetrate to that other realm. Perhaps if our psychic abilities develop further, we may be able to better enter that realm. However, there are plenty of negative proofs. When we violate the listed principles, there are invariably and inevitably negative consequences, disasters, crises, and so on. I am not saying that every bad thing that happens is a moral consequence. We do live in that kind of world, one that manifests separation so that many natural processes and many human-caused conditions can impact on us on an essentially random basis. Negative proofs are not so satisfying as are direct proofs, but they do matter and are, for us, real. There is both an intuitive and a knowledge-based position. It is not dogma or doctrine. It can be changed or evolve over time as people inquire and compare notes. On those reforms and foundations, we, the people, can start a completely different cultural system that emphasizes oneness, love, community, service, and creativity. On that foundation, we can develop a society that is sustainable and that can evolve toward the realization of oneness. The old order will, with much pain, pass away. Thank you.
Well, you gave us a lot. I don't know how we move towards city states. I mean, it sounds nice.
You got to do it yourself.
You're advocating or you're suggesting that in our relationships that we cultivate, that from that will evolve another order, maybe? Mm.
I'm saying that we have so little time that we just have to make things happen because the government never will. I voted for Mr. Obama, okay? But he has an incredible set of agendas to deal with. And he's locked into a lot of things. And he's playing along with the imperial plan, just like all the others have done. He says that we don't torture. Then, the very next day, he says, well, we will be continuing to send people abroad. You know, special renditions. Now, who can be renditioned? Anyone, including an American citizen, just disappears. And what do they do in those foreign venues? They torture. So, we were told a very nice lie. When he says that we're really giving the Iraqis freedom, I haven't heard anyone tell me that the 100 orders that Paul Bremer imposed on the Iraqi constitution have been withdrawn. And what do they do to Iraq? They turn it into a U.S. transnational slavehold. That's what they do. If Iraq is to be free, it has to be free, not under the rule of 100 orders. And we can take other things. All this concern about Iran. Why do we want Iran? Well, the big plan is to take pipelines from the Caspian Basin. You know, all the stands, like Kazakhstan. Take pipelines, put them across Afghanistan, put them across Iran. Over to Turkey. They have a border. Across. And guess where it goes across? Right through the Bonsteel base in Kosovo, which is still there, the biggest base in world history, over to Europe. And the other plan is to take oil and gas and to ship it across Afghanistan the other way. And that's the infamous Unocal pipeline that you may have heard about, over to Asia. Now, when China tried to buy that Unocal pipeline plan, we said very respectfully, no. That is our national priority. It is a priority of our corporate interests. And you wonder why we are there. This is what they're doing at a time when it will take all these years to develop those pipelines, even if we win everything, and so on. Meantime, we have a world that's going to fry. If we have even one gram of human-caused greenhouse emissions after 2016, and some people are now saying 2012. And if you come to this afternoon, I will tell you about all those emissions and how that all works and why there's a lot of bad news and what you'll have to do to keep it from being bad news. And what that comes out to is to kind of unbelievable. Thank you.